Well, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you.
To New York. I guess you've been doing a lot of traveling.
Well, this is really the beginning. I mean, I've been doing... They're telling me this is the beginning. It doesn't really feel like the beginning because I've been doing a lot of things in Portland and having a lot of the magazines that have long lead times and that sort of thing, and going down to Tucson and doing book and authors and wonderful things like that.
Well,
I did come to New York earlier for that.
I just learned something incredible. This is amazing that I've just been told that the Mammoth Hunters has 1,500,000 copies in print?
In print. You know how I found out? I got into my hotel room, and there were flowers there, and there were several. There was one from the paperback publisher and one from the hotel management, and there was one that said, from your 1.5 million fans. Where? And, of course, it was my publisher who had sent it, you know, but... That's how they let me know that it, the last I heard it was 1,350,000.
Which is enough for anyone.
Which is enough. I mean, 50,000 is a lot of books,
oh,
you know.
I'll say, yeah.
I mean, that's
you know, in most instances, novels today, including second, third, fourth novels, writers are usually happy if there's a printing of 5,000.
I know.
They're flattered.
This is my literary agent, and she has many, many other clients besides me, and she knows more than anyone who, you know, what the sizes of printings are. And
of course, 1,500,000 copies, that's the number of copies in print, not the number of copies actually
right,
sold.
Right, but the price, you know, the numbers have been going up because the stores and the distributors have been ordering. I'm scared to death what happens 6 months down the road if we got 500,000 copies back in the warehouse.
Well, publishers usually are fairly shrewd. They have a fairly good idea which direction the book is going, and they don't like to be stuck with a lot of returns.
That's right. That's right. So I have to take, you know, but it just, and I know, I suppose it shouldn't bother me. Somebody said, well, what does it mean to you? And I just said, I'm not sure, except I hate the idea of it, you know.
Well, the first two books in the series, they did very well, too, didn't they?
Yeah.
Tell me
really
about what did they sell? Do you recall?
The Clan of the Cave Bear in hardcover. I think that there are figures out that say something like, including book club, which is, I guess, the way they're doing it, all the hardcover, came to some 300 and some odd thousand. And the Valley of Horses hardcover, including book club, came to about twice that, about 600 some odd thousand. And then in paperback, The Clan of the Cave Bear is about 3.5 million, and The Valley of Horses is close to 3 million.
That's a real success story, isn't it? Because you got off to a late start as a writer, didn't you?
I never wrote a piece of fiction until I was 40. You know, and that was The Clan of the Cave Bear.
Mm-hmm. How did The Clan of the Cave Bear come about?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer because, you know, it's the one that says, what made you decide to write about this particular book in this particular period? Basically, what happened is that I had an idea for a short story, and I had been working, and I had 5 children, and I'd quit my job, and my 3 kids in college and 2 in high school, so they were not taking a lot of time. And I had gotten my MBA, I had been going to college, you know, for a lot of this time, too, taking night classes. And so I was here at this point in time in my life when I was no longer working. I was going to look for another job, but somehow never quite looked very hard. School was kind of over, so I wasn't studying for classes, and I wasn't, you know, taking tests and that sort of thing. And the children were almost grown. And I was at about 40, and I was at a state, I think, that was in a position to be open to some kind of a new idea and doing something with it. And I don't know where the idea came from, but it was late one night, early in 1977, and I thought of this girl or this young woman who was living with people who were different, and I knew I was thinking prehistory. Thought this would be kind of interesting, and you know, maybe I could try to write a story about it, fill up time. And I sat down and got a little bit into it, you know, maybe 10, 12 pages into it, decided that, you know, this was fun. I was really enjoying this. I mean, I've been a reader all my life, and I just hadn't thought of writing it. And the other thing I knew was that I just didn't know what I was writing about. I mean, what did they look like, and what did they wear, and what did they eat, and where did they live, and, you know. And then that sent me off to the research, and it was when I got into the library and discovered, you know, that in there was this period when most scientists believe there were two different kinds of humans on Earth. One of them was ourselves, which is the earliest appearance of ourselves, the ones we call Cro-Magnon. The other was Neanderthal, who's also now known as Homo sapiens to the scientific community. And here it was this Ice Age world, and I was discovering that rather than this, you know, sort of savage Stone Age caveman, here were the artifacts and the remains of a tremendously rich and variable and diverse and sophisticated culture. And why didn't I know this? How you know, in my fourth grade class in Neanderthal, I didn't learn that, you know. And then that became the story I wanted to tell. I mean, it just fired my imagination. This is perfect. This is wonderful for fiction.
But you say it started out as a short story. Did you intend this to be a novel at this point, or did you just sit down and start writing?
No.
Nobody just sits down and starts writing, do they? Because you mentioned yourself that you, as you began to write, you had to go off and get some research done in order to marshal your facts.
Well, basically it started with what I thought would be a short story, and about the next day or so I was in the library and came home with, I don't know how many, but two armloads of books, because my son met me. I told him that I would meet him downtown, and was going to the library for a couple of hours, and 4 hours late, he came to the library and found me. 16-year-old sons don't like to be stood up by their mothers, you know.
They don't like to go to libraries either.
So I said, good, you can help me carry this down, Marshall. And I just sat down and started reading and got just, you know, was reading and just fascinated and started taking notes. And it was, I think, somewhere in the middle of that, probably I should have known when I came home with 50 books that I did not need, that I was not writing a short story, but I think it was somewhere in the middle as I was reading the material and the characters and the story would grow, it suddenly would fire a new idea or a new character thought. And I said, okay, I'm going to do a novel. And then I did a very, very simple overview because, you know, you've got to know, I didn't know how to write.
An overview, you mean?
I would like a page and a half kind of an outline, mm-hmm. just kind of get my direction going. And I sat down at the typewriter, my, you know, standard kitchen table, right? And I started to tell the story to myself. And it started to grow and take shape, and I ended up totally obsessed, working 14, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, not even wanting to do anything else. And some 6 months later, I had this stack of, I think I estimated some 450,000 words of a novel that I was calling Earth's Children by then, and it had fallen into six parts. And when I went back to read it, I went, oh my God, this is terrible. And I didn't know how to write. So then I thought about taking a class in creative writing, and I said, wait a minute. You know, if I take a class, I'm going to be going 2 nights a week or 2 days a week, and I'm going to take a class for 2 hours a night, and I'm going to write what some teacher wants me to write. And I was fired up. So I started to get the books on how to write fiction from the library, get my daughter's, you know, refresh myself, my daughter's college literature books that talk about what makes characterization and what makes scene and what makes dialogue. I went back and started to rewrite and discovered about halfway through the first of these six parts that I had another 100,000 words, and I got a writer's block that you can't believe, you know. I was saying, this is going to be 150,000, I mean, it's going to be 1.5 million words. How can I possibly write one novel? And I looked carefully at these six parts, and I realized that I had covered the entire continent of Ice Age Europe. I had hundreds of characters, and each one of these six parts was a totally different story. It just had the same main character. So I said to my husband, I've got six books. And he said, what are you talking about? You've never even written a short story, and now you say you're going to write six books? And I said, I know, but I've got six books. So he said, you know, that was kind of the decision. And I went ahead then and finished the first section, and it became about 200,000 words, and that was The Clan of the Cave Bear. Went back and rewrote it at least four times, sections of it many, many more times than that, until I was satisfied that what I had was a novel, was a piece of literature, was a work that I could say was something that ought to be published, I mean, that was publishable. Because certainly, I mean, my standard were the books on the shelves, and if I couldn't write a book that read like the books that were already published. It wasn't good enough to be published, you know. And that's how it got from a short story to a series.
Well, you had all of these pages, these manuscript pages. What did you do with them?
You mean that first?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's my outline for the whole six-book series.
You finished the book?
Yes.
What did you do with the book?
Oh, now I had a finished copy. Now I had my fourth or fifth draft on 20-weight bond paper and carbon film ribbon. I mean, perfect, because I had by that time gotten books on how to get published, and one of the things that they said was do a good job of presentation and make it look professional. And not about that time, you know, when I was thinking about I'm really serious about writing, I decided to join a writer's club to try and learn from other writers more about the process. And I went, it was called Willamette Writers in Portland, Oregon, and I went to my very first writer's conference in about August of 1977. And there happened to be a woman there who was a New York literary agent who was, you know, what they do at writers' conferences. They bring people from the publishing industry. It's agents and editors and writers to give workshops and lectures and talks to people, and as particularly aspiring writers. And there was this woman who was very articulate and gave this speech that I was very much impressed with. And I approached her afterwards and I told her I was writing a book. And she gave me her business card and said, query me when you're done. Well, now I had this finished manuscript.
That was very generous, because many New York agents require writers to have an agent before they will consider them. To have an agent to get an agent.
Well, I have to say that as it turned out, Jean Nagar, I think, is an exceptional agent in many, many ways. But I didn't know that really at the time, because she had just been someone that I spoke to. So when I finished the novel, my first approach was not to go to this agent. I then went to the library and got books, you know, Writer's Market and so on, and I started, in my ignorance, in my unknowledge of the publishing world, I thought, well, why should I pay an agent 10% if I can get it published myself? Never think that way. Wrong. You know, agents can do wonderful things for you. And but I did. I sent off queries and sample chapters and got back standard rejects. You know, half page. They come on tablets, I think. You know, they get a manuscript and shove it in and send it back. That were basically, you know, rejections. And after getting a few of those, I ate a little humble pie and said, maybe this literary agent really does know a lot more than I do, and I think I will try her. And I wrote her a letter. And I wrote the best letter I could. I had no writing credentials. I had no anthropology or archaeology background. I just had to get her interested. And she wrote me back and she said, it sounds interesting. Send me the manuscript. And she was then the one who took me on as a client. She loved it. She said I'd created a whole new world, and that she wanted her agency to represent me, and then she was the one who found the publisher.
Well, that's an incredible story. The situation was somewhat different when you went ahead with The Valley of the Horses.
Well, by that time, of course, I had one book published, and the publisher had been quite pleased with the success and was more than willing to negotiate for the second one.
Well, with The Mammoth Hunters, you are now halfway through?
Halfway through the series, yes.
The pronunciation of your lead character, I just looked at it kind of mentally in my mind, but I wasn't sure. How do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Ayla. I say Ayla.
Ayla.
Ayla, yeah.
But she discovers a lot of different things, doesn't she? But not the wheel yet.
Well,
is that going to come?
Well, you have to remember that in hunting-gathering societies, the wheel was not very efficient, because you're really traveling over pretty rough ground, and wheels work best on fairly flat or fairly paved ground. So the wheel didn't need to come, although it is interesting that at least in some of the ancient Mayan cultures, for example, they found wheeled toys, although they did not use wheels and as part of their adult way of living. In terms of the period that I'm writing about, one of the things that intrigued me was that there were so many inventions and innovations at that time in our history. And I kept thinking, what was it like before we had these things, and how did they get invented? What made us decide to domesticate animals, for example? And there were some things that I just needed to introduce, like the people who had been making fire for about 500,000 years that were pretty confident of it, may even be as much as a million and a half, but at least 500,000 years. But the very first examples of using iron pyrite and flint to strike a spark and create a much quicker fire dates back to that period in time when they have found a piece of iron pyrite that was sort of rounded off with a big nick in the middle, a big dent, a rut, where it had been just struck so many times. So they knew that it had been used to make fire from that. And I wanted to include so many of the things, of the needle that was discovered. And it may have been independently discovered many places. But the needle is an extremely important invention. I mean, it's a thing, and it's got a point at one end and an eye at the other end. And, you know, the design is yet to be improved upon. But what it tells you about the people is even more important. Because what it does say is they were sewing clothing. And they were probably decorating clothing because they have found skeletons. For example, in The Mammoth Hunters, which is set in the Ukraine, there's a burial of two children who were buried head to head. And around each body, you could see from the way the bone, there were about 3,000 hand-carved ivory beads. And you could see from the way they fell that they had probably been sewn onto clothing. And you could get an idea of the kind of clothing they wore. They seemed to be trousers or tunic, with a tunic, something that went down the leg and something that sort of fell at tunic length. And they had various kinds of necklace things. And even there was one burial where they found what they think they must have worn, something like a Davy Crockett's coon or a hat with a big squirrel tail, because they could find the squirrel bones, the tail bones of the squirrel, right up behind the head and so on. And that tells you something else. That says, you know, who's got time to hand-carve ivory beads if they're grubbing for a bare existence? It tells you something about what's happening in that society and in that culture.
It's amazing that man survived at all when you think about it. It's a good thing there were so many of us, but when you think that man had to go out and experiment with foods, many of which would kill him, and all sorts of things that would hurt and harm him, and yet mankind has somehow survived over all those centuries.
Well, I think that it's not as difficult as we think. You see, we would go out now, and then we might experiment with foods that would kill us because we don't know. I was speaking on the way over that there's a survival in the wilderness. This is one thing. There's also a survival in New York City. There's a whole other set of things that you have to understand to survive in a city. There's another kind of set of things that you have to learn if you're surviving on a farm, for example. But surviving as a hunter-gatherer, it's a fascinating thing that one of the studies, or several of the studies that have been made, is that among the Bushmen and among various Indian tribes and so on, that they spend no more than 2 to 3 hours a day providing everything that they need for their existence. Food, shelter, clothing, everything. The whole rest of the time is devoted to leisure.
One thing that was interesting is your use of language. I noticed that Anthony Burgess, when he wrote the dialogue for a movie called Quest for Fire, mm-hmm. Created a kind of a language that seemed to me more grunts and groans than anything else. But you actually have them speaking in almost a modern idiom.
Absolutely.
Tell me about why you approached the language.
Okay, well, first of all, I read an article that Anthony Burgess wrote about the dialogue that he created for Quest for Fire. And he did not create it for the people who lived 80,000 years ago, which was the setting of that movie. He created it for the people that were probably the first to use fire, which were Homo erectus. And that was 500,000 years ago. So there was his perception of what he was creating and what they eventually used in the movie were just not at all in synchronization. I have really been going into the research, and I have been looking at the material and going in some great depth to find out where we are and what we were doing. What we know from the skeleton, for example, is that these people had exactly, we're talking about Cro-Magnon now, had exactly the same body that we do, exactly the same neck and throat structure, had exactly the same language capability. And in doing some studies in linguistics, what you find out, or what most linguists believe, is that if you have an ability to speak, you will speak. The only difference is what culture you're raised in will determine what you speak. But they believe, linguists really believe, that there is almost a, you wouldn't exactly call it a demand that's like food or like sleep, but it's very close to that, that there is something that is a real requirement for people who can speak to speak. And if we're looking at people who have the same capability as we do, most scientists believe that they were speaking with the same ease and facility. So it is much, much more accurate. I mean, I thought for a while, I thought about, well, let's invent some kind of a little, you know, archaic sounding language. Except people don't talk to each other in archaic language. And it would have been just as phony, because I made it up, as any language that we're speaking. And the evidence of the culture and the evidence of the structure of the bones indicates that they were speaking with as much complexity as we, and the most... I was thinking in myself that this is a translation. And when you translate with the idioms. You try to make it read easily. And that's actually a more accurate representation than if I had invented some kind of a phony language.
But you know, we're almost out of time, but I do want to ask you about one thing. I noticed in the Mammoth Hunters, you certainly have a lot of steamy sex scenes, and the publicity people sent me a statement here. This is a statement dealing with the sexuality in your second book, The Valley of Horses. Weren't you taking a chance in offending your potential readers by making your sex scenes so vivid, or was it the opposite?
Well, I felt that it was absolutely essential to the story, that this was not at all gratuitous, for several reasons, one of which is if you are creating an entire world and you leave out an element that is as important in defining cultural attitudes and social mores as sexuality is, you're leaving a gap that becomes obvious for its omission. Secondly, there is a great deal of... I mean, I've been to some of the sites, and I've been in some of the caves, and there is a very obvious sexual component when you are there. It's not in the pretty coffee table books that they sell to the general public, but there's a very obvious sexual component, except that it seems to be that the sexual symbols are female. You find very little phallic symbols. You find the symbolic and sometimes very graphic symbolizations of women. And, of course, you know, we all know where we came from. I mean, I don't know why sexuality is sometimes viewed with such distaste, since it is actually the beginning of this miracle we call life.
You wonder how they knew how to do it. Now, we know how to do it because we can read Mammoth Hunter.
but why
they didn't have books.
But why wouldn't they? I mean, we did not invent sexuality. Uh-huh. And if you do a lot of reading of the anthropology, you find out that people who live in, quote, more primitive, unquote, societies, that they have a great deal of loving and touching and holding. I mean, there's one society in New Guinea, for example, where the men greet each other by touching their genitals.
But what I'm saying is somebody had to be the first to do it, and you just wonder how they knew.
Well, I think
I guess it was a process of experimentation.
Well, I think that it would be a natural thing. If you started out, for example, with a mother who is very close and loving and touching with her children, and those children would then learn to be very affectionate with each other, as they grew up and were continuing to be affectionate with each other, that would then, when they reach puberty, transfer into sexual affection. And I think it's a more natural way. We, you know, with probably fewer of the inhibitions that our society places on them.
Well, Gene Oliver, out of time, but I did want to ask you, you've got three books to your credit now, and you've got an outline to show you that you have three more to go. So after you finish your tour and you go back to... You live in Seattle, don't you?
I live in Portland.
Portland, I'm sorry. You go back to Portland, you sit down at your desk... is this going to be an easy task for you, or is it going to be the same effort that you put into the books?
And
now that you're a pro now, you can knock it off.
It never gets easier. It never gets easier. I hope that I improve, that, you know, that my level of skill, that I've learned something in the process of writing. But it never becomes easier. Sometimes it's wonderful. Sometimes it flows. Most of the time it's like pulling teeth, each word. But I would rather do that. I'd rather sit in front of a machine fighting through a writer's block than I would do anything else.
How has your enormous success affected your family?
I think my kids are going around saying, "My mother, the author." They were pretty well grown before I really had such success, and I think they're just delighted for it. But you'd really have to ask them.
Something tells me you're not going to take that bank job.
You're right. I told them that it was quite funny. What I said was, I'm going to take another, when they offered it, I have another option with a much higher risk factor. All right, I took the risk.
Yes, you did. You did it that. Well, I certainly wish you the best. I'll be looking forward for the fourth installment to come out, and I presume that in a few years maybe you'll turn to something else, some other unexplored territory.
Well, when you start back that far, you've got the rest of the world, and I've got a file with some probably 259 ideas or something, that of other stories and other things that I'd like to do. What I do know is that I want to